there are probably at least a dozen people in the room who know more about the subject of this conference than I do, because I really haven't done anything about it since the book came out. My book came out in 1970. So I'm going to resist my tendency to pontificate and talk about something unrelated. If that puts me out of the keynote speakers club, that's the way it is. I'll try to entertain you by telling you why and how I research Only the Ball Was White and how the book was received. Those of you who have done research will, I think, be interested. Those of you who are not researchers, I'll save some time at the end to answer questions about anything even remotely connected to Negro baseball or my work. First, let me say that I believe baseball behind the color line is not just black history, it's American history. It is a relic of an era when black people were segregated by law in the southern states and treated as second-class citizens almost everywhere else. As I say at the end of the first chapter of Only the Ball Was White, Negro baseball was both a gladsome thing and a blot on America's conscience. When I began work on the book, I had no idea that it would help to spawn a cottage industry. I'm absolutely amazed at the level of interest and dedication of the people in the Negro Leagues committee in the work of this committee. Many of you have gone a long way toward resurrecting Negro baseball from the graveyard of sports history. Today, there is 10 times as much interest in the subject as there was 30 years ago, and probably 30 times as much knowledge about it. I don't claim any credit for the growth because I haven't done any real research on Negro baseball since my book was published. Most of you are quite a bit younger than I am, and perhaps it could benefit from a brief discussion of what life and baseball were like during the 1930s and early 40s when I was young and Negro baseball was in its heyday. I grew up in Warren, PA, Warren, Pennsylvania, a town of 14,000 people in the northwestern corner of the state. There wasn't a single African American in town. I don't know why, because it wasn't really redneck territory. But then several nearby towns, Jamestown, New York, and Bradford, Oil City, and Meadville, Pennsylvania, had black citizens, but Warren did not. Our racism was not the virulent kind that it was found in the South in those years. There was no violence perpetrated against black people who were passing through, and I don't recall ever hearing the N-word as a child. I think that by and large, the kids at least, were more oblivious to race than racist. But I do know that black people weren't welcome in public accommodations. When I was working a few years ago on a book about the early days of professional basketball, I interviewed the owner and coach of the Warren Pens, a pro team in the National Basketball League in 1937. He often, or not often, several times he brought in the Renaissance Big Five, an all-black team from New York City, who were by far the best team in the nation in the 1930s. When they came to our town, Jerry Archibald, the owner and coach, had to arrange for them to go to Jamestown to find hotels because the two hotels in Warren would not accommodate them. I played high school basketball against black kids, but I did not know any. Even when I left town to join the Navy during World War II, I did not run into African Americans because black sailors were in segregated units in those days. It wasn't until after the war, when I went to college, that I got to know black people. During my boyhood in the 30s, I was a sports nut, like most kids in small towns. We came home from school, changed clothes, and immediately started a game of whatever sport was in season on a vacant lot. We played until supper time and then went back at it after supper. There were plenty of games to watch, too. In the summer, baseball was played three or four evenings each week by teams in the aptly named Sunset League. The players were men, not kids, who loved the game so much they came out after work, if they had a job. Remember, this was the Great Depression, to play ball. There was no admission charge, but along about the fifth inning, a guy would visit the bleachers with a tin can, and the spectators would drop whatever they could afford, probably a nickel or dime, into it to pay for baseballs and the umpire. The best Sunset League players made up the Warren semi-pro team. The semi-pros played teams from nearby towns on Saturday and Sunday and maybe earned $5 a game, depending on the gate. When a touring black team came to town, the semi-pros played them too. Those games were generally on weekday evenings because the black clubs scheduled their Negro League games on weekends in the big cities to draw bigger crowds. Sometimes barnstorming black clubs would schedule two games on a weekday. I well remember the Homestead Grays playing a twilight game in Warren and then jumping into their bus for an hour-long ride to Olean, New York for a night game. I've been making two points with this personal reminiscence. The first is that baseball was king of the sports world during my childhood. College football was pretty big, and a heavyweight fight would cause excitement. But pro football was covered back among the truss ads, and pro basketball was almost invisible, except in a handful of cities on the eastern seaboard and in the Middle West. The second point I've been making is that I knew Negro baseball existed even as a child, because one or two black teams played in my hometown every summer. Not everyone knew it. Larry Ritter, who wrote The Glory of Their Times, possibly the best baseball book ever written, told me that when he was growing up at that time in New York City, he had no idea that black teams were playing in Yankee Stadium when the Yanks were on the road. After World War II, I started college in New Jersey, and during the summers I worked and played semi-pro baseball back home. In 1948, my last year as a semi-pro, I played against the barnstorming Indianapolis Clowns and one other black club. I think they called themselves the Harrisburg Giants, although they were a far cry from the powerhouse Giants of the 1920s. So you might say that I had a part in Negro baseball, albeit a very, very small part. I graduated from college in 1950. And for the next 16 years, I was a reporter and editor on newspapers in New York, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. Two of the four papers I worked on are now defunct, but I don't think there's a cause and effect there. I was a news editor on the New York World Telegram when it died in 1966, and I decided to try freelancing for a living. I'm still at it. In the winter of 1966-67, I was working on a short story. The story was set in my memory of a black song and dance man who was a member of a medicine show troupe that played in Warren for a week or so one summer when I was 8 or 9 years old. Chances are some of you have never heard of a medicine show, so I'll explain that it was an outdoor comedy show leading up to a pitch for a cure-all potion. The pitchman would assure the audience that the potion, which no doubt was heavily laced with alcohol, would cure cancer, lumbago, the common cold, and whatever else ails you for $1 a bottle. Our baseball diamond was right next to the field where the medicine show's wagons were set up, and each day this black performer would sit in the bleachers and watch us play. I don't think he ever spoke to us. In any case, 30 years later, I was trying to invent a story about him and his life when I got to thinking about the black teams that had barnstormed through Warren in my youth. It occurred to me that I had never read much of anything about them, so I checked my local library. I found autobiographies of Satchel Paige and Roy Campanella, but there wasn't a whole lot in those books about Negro baseball. Paige's book was heavy on Satchel Paige and his droll humor, and Campy's book was mostly about life on the Ely Giants and his major league career. Pretty skimpy stuff for my purposes. So I decided to try to write a book on Negro baseball. I sent a proposal about a book to A.S. Barnes, which at that time published sports books. They rejected the idea, so I sent it to Prentice Hall. Today, Prentice Hall publishes mostly textbooks and reference books, I think. But at that time, it had a big trade book division, too. Prentice Hall liked the idea, and in May 1967, I signed a contract to produce a book in 1 year. I was given an advance on royalties totaling $3,000, $1,500 on signing the contract, $750 when the editor had half the manuscript, and $750 when it was finished. I'll get back to those figures later, because they had an effect on the book's content. Now, I have one great advantage over most of you folks who do research. I live less than an hour from the New York Public Library, one of the three great research libraries of the world. The ink was barely dry on my book contract before I arrived at the library. There I found one of the rare copies of Sol White's History of Colored Baseball, an invaluable guide to Negro baseball in the 19th century. I also found books by Doc Young and Edwin Bancroft Henderson, both authors of books on black sport. A nearby branch library had nearly complete files of Sporting Life and the Sporting News. Original copies, by the way, not microfilm. They were bound in bound volumes, and the pages were yellowing and brittle, but very readable. Most important for my purposes, in a branch library in Harlem called the Schomburg Collection, I found microfilm of all the major black weekly papers. I spent much of the summer reading this stuff. I was working 30 hours a week on magazine articles to feed my young family. My wife and I had a 10-year-old son and an 8-year-old daughter, and 30 hours on baseball. Over about 4 months, I read all the literature I could find on Negro baseball, the sporting press from 1884 to about 1905, and enough microfilm to cross my eyes. I did not read all of the black press, however. For each year, beginning, I think, in 1906 and ending about 1952, I would read all the issues from March through November of one of the black weekly papers. Generally, I would cover the Chicago Defender for 1 year, then the Pittsburgh Courier for the next year. Occasionally, I would look for something I was pretty sure appeared in the Afro-American or the New York Age, but the Defender and Courier were my chief sources. Here's a tip for an ambitious and tireless researcher. Read all the major black weeklies for every year, and you can produce a book that is much richer in detail than Only the Ball Was White. By the fall of 1967, I had notes for every year from 1885 to 1950, an index card for each player I found mentioned, and a fairly good idea of where Only the Ball Was White was going. Now I was ready to flesh out my story with some oral history. All I had to do was locate some old players and arrange to interview them. Piece of cake, right? Today, if I wanted to find the 100-odd survivors of the old Negro Leagues, I could probably do it in a couple of hours just by talking to folks in this room. That was far from the case in 1967. It seemed that when the Negro Leagues expired for good in 1960, everybody, even the players, forgot about Negro baseball and, by and large, lost touch with one another. I knew that Roy Campanella had a liquor store in Harlem, so I visited him there. I wasn't especially interested in interviewing him because he had written about his experience with the Ely Giants in his book, It's Good to Be Alive. Campy wasn't hostile when I explained my mission, but he wasn't particularly helpful either. But he did tell me that Buck Leonard was alive and well in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, and that Judy Johnson was a scout for the Phillies. I wrote to them and followed up with phone calls to arrange for interviews. One of Judy Johnson's best friends was Bill Yancey, who lived near Philadelphia, so I got his address and checked him. I visited Bill twice that fall, once to interview him about his life and once to arrange to borrow photos from his fairly extensive collection. Probably a third of the photos of individual players, and Only the Ball Was White, came from team photos belonging to Yancey. I also visited Delaware to interview Judy Johnson, in North Carolina, to see Buck Leonard. Marvelous men and marvelous interviews. Incidentally, I was very well received by all the old players and widows I visited. They were most courteous and most willing to help me. I located most of my interviewees piecemeal. That is, one old player would know the whereabouts of another one or two, and that one would tell me about another one or two. I can't recall how, but somehow I learned about an organization called the Old Ballplayers Club of Chicago. That organization put me in touch with several old-timers and widows in Chicago, making it feasible financially for me to make a trip, since I would be able to interview six or seven over 2 days. I was constantly trying to make such package deals to save money, but I couldn't always do it. Early on, I had the address of Cool Papa Bell in St. Louis, but I couldn't afford to visit him because I knew of no other players in St. Louis, and one wasn't enough to justify the trip. I did make an exception in the case of Satchel Paige, but to the surprise of no one who knows Satchel, he wasn't home in Kansas City on the date he had arranged to see me. I finally finished a manuscript in September 1969, a year and a half late. Earlier, I mentioned that my advance on royalties had an effect on the book's contents. Now I'll tell you why. Anyone who looks at Only the Ball Was White with a critical eye will realize that the narrative stops rather abruptly. After I got Jackie Robinson into the major leagues, I kissed off the remaining years of Negro baseball in short order. I have about four pages for the eventful years from 1948 through 1955, when scores of African Americans were going into organized baseball and the Negro leagues were going down the tubes. The reason was simple. I had been working on this book nonstop for several months, and I needed the last $7.50 to pay the bills. It was a clear case of commerce triumphing over art. The book was published in May 1970. It got generally respectful reviews, but it was no blockbuster. Jim Boughton's Ball 4 came out at the same time and was far and away more popular, probably deservedly so, since Ball 4 was the first of the tell-all sports biographies. Only the Ball Was White was excerpted for newspaper syndication, and after Satchel Paige was elected the Hall of Fame in 1971, the book got me assignments for stories on Negro baseball from the New York Times Magazine, Boy's Life, and a couple of other magazines. I also was corresponding with a number of people who were turned on to the subject by my book. Some of them may be here today. Over the next couple of years, Prentice Hall considered but rejected the idea of putting out a paperback edition. They also tried to auction paperback rights to other publishers, but there were no takers. Prentice Hall turned down my proposals for a biography of Josh Gibson and a book of biographical sketches of the first four or five men named to the Hall of Fame from the Negro Leagues. Only the Ball Was White went out of print in 1976. Total sales of the hardcover have been, I think, around 8,000. Like many other publishers then, Prentice Hall was not very forthcoming with precise numbers, but I know that 4,850 were sold at the full price, and I'm guessing that around 3,000 were sold at discounts of 50% or more. About the time the book went out of print, I sent a proposal to 12 publishers for a sequel covering the early years of baseball's integration and the demise of the Negro Leagues. No takers. For that story, we had to wait for Jules Tiguel's excellent Baseball's Great Experiment some years later. In 1981, I pitched the idea for a paperback reprint to 13 publishers and struck out. By that time, John Holway had two or three books in print. William Brashler had published his biography of Josh Gibson, and Tiguel's book and Don Ragosin's Invisible Men were just around the corner. Interest was growing in the subject of Negro baseball, and in 1984, my book finally went into a paperback edition by McGraw-Hill. They dropped it 3 or 4 years later, and since 1991, Only the Ball Was White has been an Oxford University Press paperback. I've talked a lot about myself and my experiences with the book. Now let's broaden the perspective and consider what Negro baseball meant, not just to African Americans, but to Americans of every race and creed. I've already touched a bit about that, on what it was like, what it meant to small town fans, at least in the North. It was very important to us because Negro baseball showed us some talented athletes who happened to be black, but whose blackness was not their most striking attribute. Their athletic skill was. In short, black teams showed us that African Americans were not shuffling fools as they were often portrayed on the stage and in the movies of those days. Therefore, they broadened our understanding of America. What did a Negro baseball mean to African Americans? Obviously, the men on the player panel to follow me can address that question better than I can. But my impression is that Negro baseball was second only to the black church as a linchpin of black America. The teams were loyally supported. A big ball game was a social occasion as well as an athletic contest, and some folks dressed to the nines when they went to the ballpark. Some teams had fan clubs and opened the season with a parade and maybe a fashion show. The last all-black teams were dying about the time Only the Ball Was White was published. All the major league teams had long been integrated. Even in the deep South, most minor league teams had black players. And not incidentally, those players suffered the same kind of abuse that Jackie Robinson had endured in 1946 and 47. I do not mourn the demise of Negro baseball, even though I agree with those who point out that black communities lost something when black baseball expired. I do not agree with those who think it would have been better if the white leagues had simply absorbed the all-black teams with no attempt at integration. I think that Jackie Robinson, Larry Doby, Monte Irvin, Roy Campanella, and the other black pioneers in big league baseball played a major role as harbingers of the civil rights movement. I well remember that after Robinson's triumphant year with the Montreal Royals in 1946, my college psychology professor remarked that Robinson's success as an exciting ball player and a man of extraordinary courage would do more for race relations than any number of sermons and well-intentioned admonitions. I believe that to this day. If you remember one thing about this little talk, let it be an understanding that Negro baseball and its passing are not just black history. They are American history. And those of you who are resurrecting that history are doing a service to all Americans, not just African Americans. When I started talking, I told you that those of you who aren't much interested in research and writing, that you'd get a shot at me later about things that interest you about Negro baseball. So if you have any questions, I'll do my best to answer them. And if I can't, I'm sure there are people in the room who can. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Did you ever get the interview page, or you never?
Yes, I did. But no, after the book was
after
out.
After the book, I'm sorry.
I went to his induction, and he was very effusive. He even recognized my name and when he was introduced to me. And was very, oh, this is the guy who wrote the book. But I never saw him before, and I never saw him play, interestingly enough. He wasn't around Pittsburgh when I was growing up. Yes, sir.
Mr. Peters.
Yes, sir.
For years, I've tried to come up with a more catchier title in your book. How did you come up with that title, Own Your Ball Is What?
Well, it started, and it isn't really accurate when you think about it, because I think most black teams, at least in the North, played the majority of their games against whites, semi-pro whites. So it didn't really act. It started out as a chapter title on the Negro Leagues. My outline, I titled each chapter, and the chapter that was going to be about the Negro Leagues was Only the Ball Was White. Well, the publisher liked it, and that's how it wound up.
It's a great catch-up.
Yes, sir.
Which books by Doc Young did you find it when you did your initial research?
The only one that I can think of now, and I'm not even sure I know the title, Negro Baseballs and How Baseball Players and How They Made the Major League. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
That's the one that I can remember right offhand.
How helpful was that for me?
Not very, for my purposes. Okay. Because it really didn't have much about the Negro Leagues. It had to do with how the men gained acceptance as Major League players. I assume you've read it.
Just glanced at it.
Well, I don't think it's required reading for somebody researching the Negro Leagues, because it's a fine book for what he was trying to do, but it doesn't tell you much about the Negro League. Yes, ma'am.
You said something about owning making a remark about something you said in the book, that some people felt that black people lost out when the Negro Leagues ended. Is that what you said?
Well, there is a school of thought, including, I think Jules Tigel may make that point, that the black community was diminished by the loss of Negro baseball. And so there is a small group, I think it's small, group of people who think it would have been better if the teams from the black leagues had gone in toto into the white league.
Because what it reminded me of when you said that is two other things that have happened. And that is, one, when they racially integrated elementary and secondary schools in the South, after the Brown decision, African Americans who had positions like principal and teacher and administrator, when they absorbed them into the black and white school, the white people got those jobs. And I know one person in particular who ended up coming to Harrisburg. This is many years before I knew him. And I think he used to teach Latin and be a principal or something. I think he came here and ended up working at the post office. The other thing that you might be, this group might take familiar with or sympathetic to, I don't know, is that when Title IX required equal opportunity for girls in sport, that's an oversimplification, a lot of, if you had a men's athletic director and a women's athletic director, sometimes they got merged into one athletic director, and they were virtually all men who were getting those positions. So a lot of women had negative feelings about, some of the integration of male and female.
That happened in baseball, too. I know of no manager from the black leagues who went directly into a managing job in the minors. There, later on, some came in, but a lot of people lost their, no question about it, that was a loss. I just feel that a greater good was served by integration.
It's reminded me of
that. Yeah. Okay? Yeah.
I was just going to say that we would have been a lot better off if those publishers had decided to take you up on some of those proposals that you had in the book.
It all eventually
had to
got
wait
done.
For, yeah. Well, it got done, but some of the writing is pretty bad. It's coming. And at least we would have known it was done very well if you had done it. Thank you. Very, very
yes, sir.
So we're a little bit ahead of schedule, so Larry's going to entertain you with some